The Culinary Libertarian Podcast, Episode 5. Hey everybody, welcome back to the Culinary Libertarian Podcast. You can find and like me on social media at theculinarylibertarian.com/podcast page. And if you wish, you may support me with my Patreon or Bitcoin or PayPal account on the right-hand side of the page, and send me an email also for comments or questions or suggestions at the bottom of the podcast page.
Hey folks, today I'm talking with Colin Craig and Brandon Hampton of Melio Knives. I know the quality of the recording isn't always perfect on this particular episode. I don't really know why, and I don't really know what to do about it. I've done all that I can figure out to clean up as much as possible. Bear with it. It's worth listening to because there's some fascinating information about how knives are made and how they're made now. There's good information about strength and durability and sharpening ability that I should have known, but sometimes we just sort of overlook the things we work with on a daily basis. So without further ado.
Hi everybody. So I'm here with Colin and Brandon from Melio. Did I say that right?
Yeah.
Yes.
It looks like perfect. Meglio, but it's an Italian word. And tell me what the Italian word means.
So Melio is much like the Spanish word mejor, and it simply means better. So
the
goal was to make a better chef's knife. And, you know, me and my brother, Bobby, who's not on the podcast with us today, we both grew up in my grandfather's Italian restaurant. So Italian food was always coursing through our veins. So it was a simple leap to want to incorporate that somehow in our business venture. And when I started making knives, I was making them with Dwayne Dwyer from Strider Knives, and we always were using better materials than everyone else. And so when I wanted to go off on my own and focus on culinary knives, you know, the goal was the same thing, to increase the quality of the materials provided.
Okay. Well, I will tell you that when I looked at your website and saw the visual, the first thing is that the visual is stunning. I don't think I've ever seen a collection of knives that are just like, oh my God, these things are just stunningly beautiful. And I think the idea of talking about a blade as being a thing of beauty is probably a subculture of people who are going to recognize that that's the case. But you guys have done amazing work.
Awesome. Thank you so much for that.
You're welcome. I wanted to hold them and cut things. It's like, oh my gosh, I have to use this. So I know that, Brandon, you mentioned a little bit about wanting to make knives because of your experience and your heritage. But what was really the impetus to becoming a knife maker, or at least a duo of knife makers?
So let's see. Once I got out of high school, I went on to get a degree in history. And while I was going for that degree, I suppose there were a lot of avenues I could go into just to fund my academics. I was fortunate in finding Strider Knives, which was near the university I attended. And they made all sorts of tactical knives. So we worked with first responders, tier one assets, all sorts of crazy individuals. I ended up going there basically because I found out that the world's premier tactical knife maker happened to be down the street. And that's when I met Dwayne Dwyer, one of the owners of Strider Knives. And we immediately melded. He's a history nut. When I'm at his shop, he'll pull out random maps from Iwo Jima and other things that are just highly intriguing to a history nut like myself. Right from the get-go, we had a pretty good connection. He kind of took me under his wing and showed me how to make knives, and I already loved cooking, like I said. I found it frustrating working on knives that just could not fail for individuals and tactical missions, and making these pieces that were using the most technologically proficient steels and non-steels out there, and then going home and being forced to cook with knives that were other than that. and so once I finished my degree, I went on to law school, where I was forced to no longer work while I was studying, and it was torture for me. And my brother had told me, well, why don't you do what you love, because all of your law notes seem to be full of knife drawings. And so, and he was already much the businessman himself. We grew up in a family of entrepreneurs, and I'll be honest, it took a little bit more push for me. I think he was really the driving force. I'm the slow, steady guy that likes to be in the shop making the knives, the one who wanted me to be out purchasing materials and building my grind room and working on machinery to work with the steel that is so much tougher than what most people will work with. Him getting me up and out there and kind of the confidence to start this venture was imperative. And then we ended up meeting Colin further on down the road, which was great. I think we had the admin side down to a certain extent, and I think we had the knife making down to a certain extent, but we really needed somebody with the vim and vigor of Colin ready to launch us into the next level. And he's been the third brother we never knew we had, and it's been great having him on board, and life has been great ever since.
Well, that sounds like an excellent fit, and it's always nice to sort of meet the yeah. from another mother. It doesn't always happen, but when it does, it's just an awesome thing.
Absolutely.
Is there such a thing as classic knife making? I'm thinking about those stories, and maybe even from like the Highlander movie, where the ancient Japanese swords have been folded 1,000 times. I don't know if that's really true. It makes an awesome
narrative
for a movie. Are there various schools of thought or practice into how?
Absolutely. I find it's actually an uphill battle and a lot of education in order to bring these knives to people. I think the most common misconception is that if it is hand forged, it is a better knife. Kind of the harder it was to make, the better it will be in the end. And smarter, not harder, doesn't seem to be taken into effect very often. From a material standpoint, we can get very technical on carbon distribution and whatnot. What you're essentially trying to do when you see the old blacksmith hammering away is that iron and carbon make steel. And that's really what you're trying to do, is you're trying to mix those two ingredients together. And I try to analogize knife making to cooking, because I think it is an apt comparison. You want there to be as even of a distribution as possible. And that's why you'll hear people say, oh, it was 10,000 times. And it's this attempt to make it as homogenized as possible. So when we get our steel and it's PM grade, what PM means is particle metallurgy. And we actually atomize the steel essentially into very, very, very fine particles. So think like
a fuel injector. Yeah.
So you're almost working with flour at this point. It's super, super fine mesh. And then to mix it, because it is a solid powder, you can mix it perfectly, and then you can put it in a high compression chamber. It's also called a HIP chamber. This squeezes out all of the gaps between the molecules. I know we're kind of going down the rabbit hole a little bit, but what you're doing is you're getting a very clean set of ingredients, and you're also perfectly and evenly distributed, and it's very consistent, reliable, and much more accurate than you could ever get with hand forging. But it is a lot less romantic than me with a leather apron and a hammer with fire all around me.
Well, that image is something that I can at least
do. Yeah.
Now, you're talking to a baker, so you're talking about various flours, and so I can sort of understand at least the idea of taking, let's keep it to baking, that we're going to use a combination of white flour and whole wheat flour to make our loaf of bread. And depending on how much we change the ratios, we're going to change
exactly
the finished product. I grasp that. Now, the whole high compression chamber thing, sorry, he left me behind.
Yeah.
That's okay. I am not a metallurgist in any way, shape, or form. There's no reason I should be able to talk to you on that level. That's all right. I was going to ask you a question, and I'm going to ask it now. You mentioned on the website that you err on the side of innovation.
Yes.
Since my understanding of metallurgy is that person standing at the anvil and the leather apron and the handheld sledge,
yeah.
I sort of don't understand how do you innovate in knife making. And so you've already probably answered to some degree. It sounds like you don't even really start with a piece of metal. I mean, I'm imagining you get from someplace this slab of metal and you do something to it and you make a knife. It sounds to me like that's not even close to what you do.
Well, it's not very far off. Really what we're doing when it comes to innovation is, so my teacher, his name is Dwayne Dwyer, and he's an incredible metallurgist in the world of knife making. He's a pretty humble guy himself. He won't tell you that. He's actually on the patent for a material called SM100. We're going to be making some knives out of that very soon. What's interesting is when you're doing that PM grade process I was describing before, it's a great way to make steel, and you can make a lot of different types of steel, but you can innovate and think so far out of the box that you're not even using steel anymore. The particular steel material that he helped create, SM100, is actually titanium and nickel together. But regularly, you can't get titanium to get hard enough to make into a good blade with lots of edge retention, get a high, what they would call Rockwell, which is the hardness of the steel. He was able to talk with Crucible Metallurgy and a lot of other metallurgists and work with Summit Materials to develop SM100. So hardenable titanium. And so what you end up with is a material that is as hard as steel, as tough as steel, but is 20% lighter, non-magnetic, and will never corrode. And so it's not a stainless material. There's nothing ferrous in it to rust. So it will never rust. It'll outlong our civilization, probably. That's the only knife I carry, is one that him and I made out of that material. And so I have never seen a kitchen knife made out of that. The manufacturing process is very difficult. Oftentimes when you surface grind a knife, you will put it on a magnetic table. Making a knife out of a titanium and nickel material precludes you from being able to do that. So you actually end up going backwards sometimes. And so when I surface that, a lot of it will be me burning off my fingertips, holding it real close belt. We may be using material that's currently on, you know, the space station, but sometimes you have to go backwards and the mechanical process is just to get it to work because no one else is doing it. There are no fixtures. There's not a great wealth of literature on the machining characteristics and properties. A lot of it is guesswork. Not all of it is the rock star stuff going into new titaniums and stuff like that. Even just using steels that haven't previously been used for kitchen knives is along the same path. The tool steel I use for most of my kitchen knives is very, very high toughness and very, very high hardness. And I end up being able to make a knife that doesn't chip like a lot of kitchen knives do. I know I'm already sacrilegious for saying this, but a lot of Japanese knives end up being very high hardness, which gives it a sharp edge, but very low toughness. And so you end up with a blade that chips a lot. I'll never denigrate any knife maker, but I strive to overcome these challenges that we all face by finding materials that are the best of both worlds and can achieve a higher aggregate of both hardness and toughness. So that way the end user has a more enjoyable time cooking and can focus on breaking down a tuna without avoiding bones like the plague, and can be a little more comfortable and relaxed while they're doing their job.
Well, I can tell you that, and I spent professional career, I've purchased 2 chef knives in 40 years. And the one was a Gerber back in 83. I still have it. I had to take it to a fellow to have it really ground because it was chipping. Mm. And so it is a shell of its former self, but I still use it at home. And the other one I bought was a Messermeister, which I loved, but it has the same problem. It'll get a little bit of a chip. And I can't tell you one thing about the hardness. I can tell you that I like a hefty knife. Mm-hmm. I like a 10-inch blade. I want to know that thing is in my
Absolutely.
Hand. So to me, there are some knife companies that make them very light. Yeah. I haven't carried one of yours, so I don't know the difference, but I'm not going to mention the names of the people I don't like to use. But I like it. I want a hefty knife. But I do experience the minor chipping, and so I'm either on the stone or on the steel. It's like, oh, what this is just, you know, you spend a lot of money on a thing, and what an aggravation that you're a little bit of sand in your parsley, and now you got a hole
Absolutely.
In it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think Brandon, he's very, very, very humble in the sense that he probably won't mention how hard he actually has to work on these knives to pump one of them out for a customer. He it's a lot of work with this material, whereas like if we used a lower grade material, we could probably pump two or three of them out. So it sounds like a simple solution, right? until you see them in the grind room really going at these things. So each individual one of these knives is really truly one of his babies going out. But I think that needed to be said, because I don't think he would have said it himself.
Well, then I appreciate you bringing that up. Then, Brandon, I want to ask Colin if you have, you can certainly respond. But as a cook and a baker, I recognize that there's two things going on. There is the application of skill and the application of craft. And they can sometimes overlap, and sometimes they're very distant from each other. And it's maybe an unfair question, but I'm just curious, do you find yourself favoring one of these things over the other?
Brandon, do you want to answer that? Or did you want me to answer that?
I suppose I'd like a little clarification. How do you see skill and craft being set?
So skill would be the ability in your hands, and as far as I'm, in my opinion, the definition would be, and the craft is the intellectual pursuit of finding the better.
Gotcha. I would say that they have to overlap in this, because, for instance, I use 3V steel most of the time, and that is a better steel than just about anything anyone's using in terms of carbon, in terms of hardness. The high vanadium content is a terror to me. A lot of my belts end up costing upwards of $12 a piece. They're very hard ceramic belts. I might use more than 10 of them in a typical 9-inch chef's knife, you know. So by the time it's all said and done, I've spent over $100 just in belts, you know, and I've ground my fingertips off, which is then where the skill comes into play. You know, how can I manipulate this better material fully? How can I exploit this? How can I be careful enough and innovative enough and patient enough to not overheat the blade and warp it? How can I bring out the true edge on this? I've made two tuna swords now out of CPM 3V. That's the blade steel. And I've never seen that attempted before. And after making them, I understand why no one else would. But I'll tell you, when I saw the first one I made used by Dave and Waite, he's a local sushi chef and phenom here in San Diego, up in Oceanside, the Wrench and Rodent. He was making us swordfish marrow, and he had broken down Colin, was it 200-pound swordfish?
Yeah, about a 200-pound swordfish.
Yeah, he has it's on my Instagram. He's holding this piece. It's the spine with the ribs protruding to the right, and he's going to separate the spine from everything else. And you see him wind up with this tuna sword and really concentrate, because he's going to be slicing through bone. And as he attempts this real difficult cut, he just ends up laughing as soon as it's done, because it just zips right through every bone without him applying any effort at all. And he's been a sushi chef for 20 years, maybe more, and he's never seen this. And so that's when all of the hours, all of the whetstoning, all of the blisters and the loss of all of my fingerprints all kind of comes to fruition, and I get to breathe a sigh of relief and say, okay, it's worth it. I did my job. I was able to blend the skill and craft to make something that in the end, if it doesn't work, I'll know, and there's no hiding.
Right. I understand at least the emotional satisfaction of the success of the effort. Now, mine comes more from the, you know, making the croissant that the guy says, oh my God, like being back in Paris. At least I have an appreciation of watching the end user just sort of chuckle in glee, either because it tastes good and it has that Proustian moment of transporting you back to the thing that was for you the iconic representation of croissants, or if you're, you know, the movie Ratatouille or whatever it was, there is an immense personal satisfaction.
And I will oftentimes relate the craft of knife making to cooking in a sense of I'm a very even keeled individual, but the most frustrated I've ever gotten is at myself when messing up on a knife, because I, for instance, one of my favorite dishes to make is my family's stufado. It's an Italian sauce. It takes about 8 hours to make my family's stufado. And if I was to mess up on an 8-hour sauce, I'm devastated. It takes me months to make these knives. There's nothing I can equate to to frighten me more than to see one of those if I ground it too thin, or if I, you know, most of the time, if I was to mess up on a knife, it would be, oh, now I have to resand this deeper, or now I have to adjust this a little bit further. There's very few times in, I don't know, 12 years of making knives that that I've ever made something I couldn't come back from. That's kind of the benefit of knife making, is there is a certain amount of forgiveness on the hand craftiness of it. Heat treat, not so much, but on the shaping and the polishing and the grinding and handle materials, stuff like that, you know, you definitely have at least a little bit of leeway. It can take you more work and time, but there's a little bit of forgiveness. But to truly mess up on a knife, it's very devastating. But at the same time, when I've done altruistic pieces or pieces that have some emotional significance to me, I think there's nothing I can compare that to be able to work on something. One of my good friends lost his parents, and I was able to make a knife that represented both of his parents in one knife. His father had worked on the Apollo heat shield, and I made an aluminum honeycomb composite as bolster. And his mother had always kept rose bushes. And I was able to get some Burmese rosewood and use those as the handles. And the marriage of those two into one knife that he uses every day, I can't think of something better that I could be doing with my time than making something that meant so much to me and him that lasts every day. It's incredibly cathartic.
Well, now that's, I think you've surpassed me in abilities to comprehend, because nothing, a good sourdough may take a week, not months and months and months. So that's, there's a level there of oneness that I can sort of at least intellectually understand, but I have no actual comparison to. You mentioned the handles a minute ago, and so I'm looking at your webpage. Some of the, I don't even know how to describe them, except to say they're stunning, and I have no idea how you did it. One that has like a little bit of, I don't even know what they're
resin coated green and brown together. Stabilized resin handles.
And one's blue and kind of, well, blue is the wrong word. More, well, I mean, to me, blue and brown sort of, it's just amazing. So in addition to having this skill in the blade, there's skill in the handle, and it looks really, truly like each one is absolutely unique. And we go back to that leather-clad blacksmith, and it seems to me that you are starting a whole new level of discipline where that blacksmith can take his acquired knowledge and pass it on to the next generation, and that person is going to do more with it. There's an accumulated sense of culture and history in the discipline. It sounds to me like you're starting from scratch in a discipline that doesn't necessarily have.
You know, it's a bit interesting with the handle material specifically. A lot of people are using the stabilized woods now that are injection molded with some type of resin. Are making tables out of these resin burl combos. I think it's an incredibly efficient use of wood. You know, the prettiest parts of wood typically is the burl. It's the most knotted and oldest parts of trees. And you typically wouldn't use it for a handle because of the porosity. It would have a tendency to crumble. So by filling in the voids with resin, you can create something that is both beautiful, but also you're not wasting any burl. You're being able to utilize the whole tree. Efficacy is really important for me. But as far as creating something entirely new, I don't ever want to take credit for something I didn't come up with. And I did have a very good teacher. I think because I've been doing this for so long with an individual who had such a passion for the different, I think sometimes I've actually disappointed clients when they were bringing me something really exotic. I recently had someone approach me and say, all right, I got something really crazy for you, Brandon. I got stabilized brain coral. And I said, oh, well, yeah. I mean, you really want to make sure that when you're working with it, it doesn't crumble. Because if you overheat it, even if it is stabilized, it can crumble. And he looked disappointed that I'd worked with it before. I was like, I'm sorry. I just, I've been doing this for over a decade. Like, I've worked with mammoth molar and 50,000-year-old bog, you know, wood that hasn't petrified because it's been submerged. I've worked with bone. I've used spent brass casings from bullets as countersinks and hardware. Like, if there's something new and different, I usually gravitate towards that as a challenge I'd like to accomplish and put that notch on my belt, as it were. So
that's amazing. Like I told you, the level of beauty is just spectacular, and people really need to go check out your website just to see how magnificent this is. Well, you're welcome. I want to ask you a question about the business side. As a small business owner making what might appear to be a dangerous product, are you subject to higher regulations? Does the state, either local or state or federal government, make you jump through hoops that maybe other businesses don't have to because it's a life. It's dangerous.
You know, I would say that California is not not overly friendly to the small business owner.
We watch the news. We don't know.
You know, we actually haven't been inundated with too much. You know, I did initially pursue law school, so I've, if nothing else, met a plethora of really great individuals who are more litigious than I am. And so I will often ask questions. All right, now, if I make this, you know, Qatar individual, what's my liability? You know, I'm pretty much let me do what I want. If I can make it, I want to be able to make it. That's not always how things pan out. There's very little that I would like to make that people ask me to make. I suppose people will ask me for things like shuriken, ninja stars, brass knuckles, butterfly knives, things like that that are illegal in California. I will typically shy away from, and not just because of the legalities of it, but also because they don't really interest me too much. A ninja star to me is not as useful as a really great kiritsuki. So I don't find a lot of desire to make those.
Right.
But, you know, if I wanted to make a sword, I've made a couple tuna swords and I've got a couple wakizashis. Those are shorter Japanese swords. I haven't been stopped, and there's really no legal reasons why I shouldn't be able to make those. I usually am able to do the fun projects that interest me. There's a lot of regulation when it comes to machining capabilities and the manufacturing side of things, you know, having to use specific types of coolants because of being in California. And those are chemical regulations and pretty boring and not really all that crazy. And like I said, I'm pretty much all for the ecological and conservation side of things anyway, without having my hand forced. You know, we work with a lot of chefs, Davin, as I mentioned before, and Colin actually as well. Colin's a great chef. Being able to utilize all parts of animals that they cook with, all parts of the vegetation that they're cooking with, not just using the broccoli, but using the broccoli greens. And how can I utilize the ribs so that way nothing's going to waste? Even the water that goes into the actual growing of the broccoli and the plants and everything that we're using, I want to look at that as something that was spent in the growth. Like, this is all very valuable, not just the small flower in the middle. And, you know, being forced to use sustainability or sustainable practices in the manufacturing side of things, I would feel a bit of a hypocrite if I groaned at that.
Yeah.
Right. Well, that's an impressive approach to your business. And I think that's just one more thing that makes you, person and as a company, really interesting and worth more people knowing about.
Yeah. Well, I'm surrounded by very talented individuals. I think one of the things I try to do is be good at my craft and see if I can find like-minded people, whether that's the chefs I work with or even other talented craftsmen. You know, all of my leather work, for instance, is done by AJ from Redbeard Leather, and he is
exceptional.
The most leather worker I've seen. And he's, you know, a couple miles away from me, and he works with his wife and his kids nearby. He's super down to earth, and he comes out with the most impressive work. How could I not take advantage of such a great opportunity? If you had a restaurant down the street from the world's best baker, of course you'll buy bread from him and serve it in your restaurant. Why would you waste such an opportunity? And so I'll find myself choosing to stay in my lane and make the pointy things and leave the leather work to the guy who does that as his craft. And then someone can get a chef's knife, for instance, that I made in a leather roll tooled by AJ. And so now you have the best of both worlds, and you didn't have me trying to go to Hobby Lobby and buy $40 worth of leather equipment. You should be impressed by, you know?
I think on your website, there's one knife that shows a leather sheath, I guess. And that, I'm assuming that's Redbeard Leather's.
Yeah. Handwork. Yeah. It's
very impressive. I mean, it's a small picture, but it's impressive.
I tell him, I said, put your logo real big on there. I look at it as a point of bragging that I have you doing my leather work.
Yeah.
I never want to steal his thunder. He does very impressive work, and I'm very fortunate to have him at my disposal. And you know, I've had, you know, I really try to make custom ads. And when I say custom, I truly mean that if you come to me and you describe what it is that you're trying to do, I will often at times give you my experience and what I might be able to design that might make your life better. So if you're a sushi knife and you really love a typical Yanagiba, but you find yourself running your knuckles against the board, well, I could say, well, why don't we try an offset Yanagi? So it's kind of that bread knife design where the blade dips down, but still thin it out. So that way it's still narrow from the edge to the spine. I know the Japanese would cringe at that, and it's not traditional, and that's not what we've done in the past. And I don't really care. If it works better, it works better. And so I made one, and it worked out excellent. The end user was blown away by it. And it's his go-to everyday knife now. And I thought, okay, well, great. I found something that you were going to use, the task you'd had. And I developed the tool for that task, not the other way around. Being able to design the knife with the handle and with the length and the shape and the profile and the angles and all of that, as well as the finishes. And then being able to say, all right, and now we can work with Redbeard Leather and design a custom piece for you there as well. And come up with something that, you know, we just did a piece for an individual who was getting married. I made a knife for him to cut the cake with, and it was a very And then he wanted a leather wrap that had ladybug, which is not typical, but represented to him his grandmother. And so AJ was able to design that and tool that into the leather, along with this knife design that was very unique and had grind lines basically dripping down the spine. And it came out to be this incredibly unique piece. No one's ever done anything like it before. And there's an immense amount of satisfaction being able to come up with something that is truly custom. And more than that, an heirloom piece. All of my are lifetime warranted. And that's not just as a, if it broke, I could make another one. I designed these so the handles can come apart. I can service the entire blade. There's no reason why in 50 years, if you hand me that knife, I shouldn't be able to bring it to you.
Nice. Well, that's something that nobody else is doing. I can tell you that, because even, even the $150 or $200 French knives are kind of one time only. You got this plastic handle and got what you got. And so you sharpen it until it's stubbed and then you move on. Let me ask you one question with the, I'm going to use probably the wrong words, but this hardness and strength of steel, can the chef sharpen his own knife? I mean, is it something that he cannot put on a stone, or doesn't even need sharpening? I mean, I would assume my knife needs sharpening. I would assume any knife at some point is going to need it. Can he or she put it on a whetstone and bring the edge back?
Yeah, so I typically equate sharpening as giving something an oil change. No matter how expensive, you still got to give it an oil change. You know, you'll still run into things that you'll need to sharpen out. When I talked about hardness and toughness, those are the two most relevant things for the chef. The third thing is not as relevant, but is still relevant, and that is abrasion resistance. So wear resistance is basically how hard it is to grind material off. Unfortunately, 3V, the steel I use mostly, doesn't have very high wear resistance. So it is very hard, very tough, but also a little bit harder to sharpen, which is why we try to thin out that edge so there's not much to sharpen. And it being so hard and tough means you'll be doing it less often anyway. We do currently have steel that we're trying to get in that is actually going to be even harder and tougher than 3V while being a little bit less wear resistant. So while being harder and tougher, it'll be easier to sharpen. Again, this is where I yield to experience and go with the PhDs in metallurgy. That's some wonky science you got there, but if it works, it works. You know, I'm glad you guys have temperature controlled labs, so I don't have to be doing any backyard science trying to figure that out. Yeah, there shouldn't be any trouble with sharpening your own knives on stones. Some typical high carbon steels that other custom knife makers will make, M4, actually has higher wear resistance and lower toughness. So you'll end up with a material that is not as tough as 3V and is more prone to chipping. That's actually harder to sharpen. So there's already people using stuff that is more difficult to sharpen than mine. But the other thing that's a big factor, and it actually kind of breaks my heart, honestly, because at the end of the day, my heart goes out to my chefs. I'm sure Colin feels the same way being one of them. A lot of sushi knives are very, very low wear resistance. What will end up happening is it's become, I suppose, a ritual for a lot of sushi knives to be sharpened every day. And so at the end of every day, they will ceremoniously put it on the whetstone. And it's this end of day ritual to do it every single day, which is fine, except for I'll end up with sushi chefs who wear through a knife about once a year. And these are not inexpensive knives. Some of these knives are well over $1,000. And to be getting a new one every year, well, that's just soul crushing to me. So if I can make them a knife that they do not go through once a year, then that makes my that makes my day a little brighter. You know, I want you to be able to be impressed with the ability of it to cut, but I also want it to last a heck of a lot longer than 1 year.
With less maintenance.
Yeah. It wouldn't occur to me that you could sharpen a knife to nothing in the course of a year, but then I'm not a sushi chef, so
yeah.
This is just something that's not in my wheelhouse, but...
Yeah.
That's but it sounds like an excellent goal for you. There are those three factors at play. I just assumed that a knife is a piece of metal, is the same piece of metal as everybody else's, and so the sharpening ability, the blade retention ability, is mostly the same. Although, you know, if I think for 2 minutes about the various brands of knives I've used and realize that that's not true, probably blame that on the design of the knife as opposed to the metal of the knife and the composition of the metal, because there are some designs that I think are just bad, where the blade stays, you know, a fat blade is a relative term, but it stays fat down to the actual blade, and then it just tapers off very rapidly. It's like, well, this is dumb. You can't keep this thing sharp. Who made this?
Well, it appears that you need a Melio, is what it sounds like.
Well, which is one of the reasons way back when and bought this. It was pre 9/11, and so... but I bought it for the very reason that that the blade got thin at the bottom of the blade, so I could sharpen it nice and it would hold the edge longer. Which that's why I got it. Maybe to get Emilio. So that brings us to your website. I will put on the show notes page for today's episode. But go ahead and give us the website address. And can people? I'm sure people can order them. You mentioned a couple months turnaround, so this isn't something we can get quick.
So there's a couple things that factor into that. We not only make custom knives, which we completely pride ourselves on, we also make production knives. And we're actually rolling out a 10-inch chef's knife with a Santoku and a paring knife that's going to be readily available at any given time. And you can go directly to the website and be able to order those. The 10-inch chef's knife is not going to be out for a couple more months, but we're rigorously working on that right now to get that done. Another great thing is we have all these examples of custom knives that we've already sold. So it kind of gives the end user an idea of what might kind of match what they're doing most at work. And they're able to click on there and get in contact with someone almost right away. There's other things that we're implementing too. With every customer that we have, we're actually pretty close to them and almost talk to them on a daily basis, all of us at Melio, which is kind of cool. So we do what we're working on is implementing a chef of the month. We're going to go through each and every single one of our chefs, and they'll eventually be up on the homepage, landing page for kind of like bragging rights of what they do on a daily basis. And it gives them, other people who visit our site, their bio, what they do, and maybe some ideas into stuff that they can integrate into their food. The webpage actually has a lot of work to be done, but it's almost done.
What is that address?
It's www.melioknives.com, or as a lot of people call it, Meglio Knives, which I don't correct because it's like super catchy. It's like, if you can remember it, that's cool with me.
Far more important they can find you than
do it. And Colin's really the guy to go to. He's the one to consult with. I think that he's been a huge asset for us because he's looking at it from the point of view as a chef. So when people approach him and say, I think I want a knife, and that's all they've thought through, it's easy for him as a chef to consult and be able to say, well, what is it that you're really going to use it for? Let's figure out, you know, what it is that your style of cooking is, how can we best accommodate you? And it ends up being a really nice streamlined process, honestly, where you've got a lot of people over here actually willing to help bring whatever it is that you want made to life. So.
And we make a bunch of buddies out of it. It's a super cool little community that we have going. It's a little bit different than what a lot of people have going, but we really keep in contact with everybody. And like I said, we probably talk to a lot of our customers on a daily basis, and there's a lot of them. So,
well, that's good. Do you have a Facebook page that you want to mention that we can also direct people to?
Yeah, if you just search Melio Knives, it'll pop up. There's an Instagram page, same thing. If you search Melio Knives or Melio_knives, it usually pops up. We're just about on every social media face, so we're pretty easy to find.
We've also got a Facebook group, Melio Chefs, M-E-G-L-I-O Chefs, and that's really cool. We try to bolster our clients and chefs as friends, you know, as much as we can. And that's a cool place for them to get in and, you know, show off their plating, show off the knives they got, develop relationships with each other. So that way they can do private dinners, and they can increase their business, and they've got a place to talk about knives and food and anything. So that's a super fun thing to join up to if you'd like to get in on that. There's no requirements. So.
Excellent. Well, that's a good value added thing, just some way to be part of the Melio community. And it's, I think that's a way that businesses, in my impression, are sort of going and being, it's not just end of the sale, the transaction's over, now you're part of the community. I think that's a valuable thing.
And there's also one other community I wanted to mention that's been great towards a lot of chefs who are kind of starting out in the industry, or cooks or line cooks or whatever. And they're called the Learning Chef. They're on Facebook. We do a lot of work with them for community outreach and kind of helping these new guys get on their feet without, you know, you've been in a kitchen, you can understand the whole bullying aspect of it. So like there's an environment for newer chefs to go into, and they're on Facebook as well. They're a group called the Learning Chef, and they're completely fantastic.
That's how you and I met.
That's right.
And they're actually doing a competition where the prize is one of our knives. So
wow. All right.
Do want to win one of our knives and not have to pay for it. That's a great opportunity, is going to the Learning Chef and entering into their competition.
All right. Well, gentlemen, I do appreciate this conversation. I've learned more about knives than I thought I could possibly know. And the technology is just, I'm just impressed. It's over my head, but I'm impressed.
Like I said, there's a lot of education that goes into it. I try to keep it as pedestrian as possible.
Well, for the plebe of the science world that I am, you've done well. I appreciate that. This is being recorded on the 19th, and I know that you have a knife show coming up, so I wish you lots of success with your upcoming knife show. Hope that goes well. Maybe Colin can keep me up to date in the Learning Chef group about how things went.
Of course, absolutely.
Well, gentlemen, thank you very much. And any parting comments?
Having us, it's been a pleasure being able to be on the show.
Yeah, hopefully we can do some more shows later on.
Anything else you want to say?
No, I think that covers everything. How about you, Brendan?
I think that's good.
All right, folks, that's going to do it for today. You can check the show notes page, culinarylibertarian.com/5, for the websites mentioned. Thanks a lot, and I'll see you next week.